We'll start by going to the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
With me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is botanist Larry Alla, who is with the USGS National Wetlands Research Center. He just recently won the 2014 Prairie Excellence Award, which was given by the Coastal Prairie Partnership at their annual conference just recently at the end of May. He was given the award for his dedication to coastal prairie conservation through professional and volunteer work. And Larry, I think we're going to have to talk about what all of this means. We think we know some of these phrases, coastal. We know what the coast is. We think we know what prairie is. But I think many of us really don't quite understand exactly what it is you've been working on for so many years and in particular why you were given this award. Tell us first of all about the Coastal Prairie Partnership who granted this award.
Judith, we had a meeting about 8 years ago in Texas. It was called the State of the Prairie Conference, the first of its type organized by the Katy Conservancy, which is a nonprofit west of Houston. And I was invited to give a presentation on Louisiana's coastal prairie. And as a result of that meeting, we put together a group and eventually got nonprofit status to coordinate efforts to conserve this really, really rare ecosystem.
So it's a kind of a volunteer, loose organization of various people and organizations who are committed to the coastal prairies.
They're federal agencies, university faculty, and private citizens and NGOs as well.
All dedicated to this
very
conservation.
Dedicated.
Well, tell us what coastal prairies are, why people are so dedicated and need to be dedicated to their conservation and restoration in many ways.
It's in a sense, it's sort of a learned love because coastal prairie is a tall grass prairie system that very similar to the tall grass prairie that's found all the way up to Saskatchewan, Canada. Say five dominant grasses that some of which grow tall enough that a man had to stand on his horse's back to see where he was. That's where the name comes from. We had 2.5 million acres here historically.
It formed in Louisiana.
In Louisiana, and 7 million in Texas. And it's distinctly different than prairies everywhere else in that it has a suite of species that are different, even though the dominant species are the same. We had bison and red wolves and prairie chickens and elk and, you know, people from Nebraska would have felt very at home in our coastal prairie. But because it was the most fertile land, it was the first land to fall to the plow when the railroad was completed in the 1870s. German immigrants, like the people at Roberts Cove, came down and began to plow it for rice. And that today we have, originally we thought a couple of years ago that we were down to less than 1,000 acres.
But from how many million?
Two and a half million.
2.5 million down to 1,000.
And it was primarily small stretches along railroad tracks. Every square foot of it had been plowed. But recently the Natural Heritage Program in, with the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries has located some grazed prairie that's a little beat up, but it was never plowed. It's intact, and it's south of Lake Charles, and we're all very excited to find out there's more. Texas had 7 million acres, and they have several tens of thousands of acres left, mostly grazed land. But still, it's less than 2% of what was here originally.
Well, and for those people, give us a sense of what the area you're talking about, because we use commonly the phrase prairie, you know, prairie Cajuns,
prairie
up near Eunice. How far did this coastal prairie extend in Louisiana?
Prairie is a French word, and it generally means any open grassland or meadow. And in Louisiana, it extended from Franklin in a narrow arc up to Opelousas, and then as one side of the triangle, and then it extended past Lake Charles all the way almost to the Texas border. It formed a big triangle. It's bordered on the north by longleaf pine and on the south by marsh. And I-10 goes right down the middle of it. And the early Cajuns were reluctant to move onto the prairie. They lived on the bayous that had very fertile land. And no one thought that these grasslands were good for anything except grazing. So the few Cajuns who moved out there were subsistence farmers and raised cattle and grew a little corn. They grew rice in ephemeral wetlands called platans. But the Germans came down and discovered they could grow rice. And in a matter of 20 years, almost all the prairie was gone.
Mm. Yeah. Well, let's describe this coastal prairie. As you said, people from North Dakota would have felt very comfortable here with the kinds of animals and generally the grasses. But what was different about the coastal prairie? What kinds of species made it different?
Well, let me tell you first how it's similar. It's a tall grass prairie ecosystem. That means it's dominated by grasses, big blue stem, little blue stem, switchgrass, which you hear a lot about with biofuels, eastern gamma grass and Indian grass, those five grasses. And they get very tall, they're very productive, and they depend on fire. So it's a pyrogenic ecosystem. It has to burn periodically. But within the little bit of prairie that remains, we found over 600 plant species. And, you know, that may not sound like a lot to someone who's not a scientist, but that's one of the most diverse systems in North America. Extremely diverse, and a lot of wildflowers. Really beautiful when you spend time on it, especially after a burn. The wildflower display is spectacular. And the system is also, when I began going to the Midwest and told people we got 60-plus inches of rain, no one believed we had prairie. So why do we have prairie here? It's because our clay soils are so drought-prone that if you go 3 weeks or 4 weeks without rain, the plants think they're in Kansas.
So, so do we.
Yeah, we wish we were. So, the plants are drought tolerant and they're fire tolerant and they're very tolerant of grazing, not constant grazing like cattlemen do, but the type of grazing that bison did when they would move through. And the Indians here depended on bison just as they did in the Midwest. But to tell you what's different about it, as you move from Lafayette westward, species appear and species disappear. The dominants remain the same. But when you get all the way down to South Texas, the grasses are shorter. They're more salt-tolerant grasses. When you go north into North Texas, prairies of North Texas, the blackland prairies have the same genera but different species. So the wildflowers, it would be more obvious to a botanist or a naturalist, but those systems are very different. And our system is isolated from, we don't have salinity issues because our huge marsh isolates us from the prairie. But the prairie also had an interesting geological feature called Mima mounds. The people call them pimple mounds, and nobody knows what causes them. But on the soils in Louisiana that had prairie, these mounds can go from 3 to 7 feet tall and from 10 to 30 feet wide. And in aerial photography, it looks like acne. And the plants on these mounds are very different than the plants in between. So it's a really, really unique ecosystem. And, of course, wherever it was plowed and leveled, those mounds are gone. So those are indicators of the fact that the area was never plowed. And these plants don't tolerate plowing. If you plow it, it's very, very difficult to restore and bring back.
What does plowing do to that ecosystem?
Prairie, unlike forested systems, the vast bulk of the plant is below ground. All the growing tissues are below ground. That's why they're fire tolerant. You can mow it down to the ground. You can remove all of that, and it grows back prettier than it was before. And many prairie plants, we think, lived thousands of years, grasses, and very long-lived, perennial, very competitive. One of the reasons there are no trees there is because trees are not fire-tolerant, but they also had trouble competing with those prairie plants in those droughted soils. But when you plow and you kill the below ground structures, it takes many, many years. In fact, restorations that have been done in the 30s still don't look like the remnants. This is a, something that takes geologic time to restore and very difficult to explain to people how rare it is.
You can't just throw some seeds on the ground and,
expect
it to spring up.
No.
If you are just tuning in and finding yourself mesmerized by my guest and what he's talking about, botanist Larry Alain is with us. He works for the National Wetlands Research Center here in Lafayette and just received in Texas the 2014 Prairie Excellence Award that was given by the Coastal Prairie Partnership, of which he helped to put together a number of years ago. How did you become interested in coastal prairie? What was your education and what did you receive your degree in?
Well, in 1974, I got a degree in horticulture, and I spent 17 years as a nurseryman and landscape contractor. But I always wanted to understand the science behind plants more. So in 1990, I went to graduate school and became a botanist and was lucky enough to get a job at the Wetland Center, worked on wetland issues for a year, and then I had the opportunity to go and visit a remnant prairie. And the very first time I was on the prairie, part of the work that I did was pollination ecology in graduate school. So I'm very interested in pollinators and insects. And when I walked out in the prairie with all the wildflowers blooming, the hum of insects and the diversity of bees that were visiting the flowers, I was instantly smitten. And because of my background in horticulture, you know, the number of wildflowers I thought was interesting too. And I grew up outside. You know, I come from a community of hunters and fishermen, and I knew I had never seen anything like that in nature. So I was lucky enough to be involved in a research project, and have since the thrust of my research over the last 20 years has been in coastal prairie, looking at the role of fire, how it keeps Chinese tallow trees out, what conditions are favorable for pollinator diversity and conserving pollinators, and how we restore it. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to restore what we had before, but it only makes me appreciate more how valuable those remnants are. But we do have successful restoration programs in Louisiana and in Texas. In fact, there's a 10-acre restoration in Eunice on Martin Luther King Drive that's really beautiful, and in May and in August are the peak bloom times. But then there's a walking trail. It's a good place to get familiar with it.
So you fell in love with the coastal prairie about 20 years or so ago, and you've been working with research projects since then. I think people are fascinated with what goes on at the National Wetland Center. I think it's a mystery to many people, and we're fortunate enough to have had a few of you come and talk about what you're doing there. But it's there's just a lot of magic that goes on there. And,
it's
and
an incredible
what you're studying.
Place to work.
So are these research projects, are they help through federal grants? How do you sustain these research projects?
we have direct funding that supports us, but we also compete for grants and mm-hmm. and reimbursable funds, and the you know the research more and more the research is funded by reimbursable funds, but a lot of the restorations are done by committed volunteers. And we created several years ago the Louisiana Native Plant Initiative, and we got three universities, including UL's Ecology Center, involved in growing wildflowers. So there are an army of people out there who love and care for this system that work on it. But, you know, the funding for prairie is not as strong as it is for wetlands. It's mm-hmm. a little bit harder to find because everyone's aware of our disappearing wetlands. Mm-hmm. But prairie doesn't get the same press. Maybe this will change that.
Perhaps so. And I think some people may have the mistaken idea that if we see a pasture that's full of long grass, that's prairie.
Right.
And it's not. No, it's so much more complex.
In fact, I get phone calls all the time from people who insist they have priority on their land, and it's always old field. Mm-hmm. Only once out of the hundreds of times I've gone to visit suspect prairies was it really a prairie.
Suspect
and it really
prairies.
Surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
in an industrial park on the other side of Lake Charles, and it was a really unusual piece of prairie. It had plants that are more common in Texas than in Louisiana. We don't have a good idea what the prairies look like because there's so little left when we started to look. And, it, you know, if you think each of these little pieces is just a piece of a giant jigsaw
a
puzzle.
Remnant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But,
so when you started working on it, it was part of your work searching out these patches of prairie?
Mm-hmm.
How, from the time you started until now, how much do you think you've discovered yourself?
Well, we've found several hundred acres, but in collaboration with others, especially in Texas, we've found thousands of acres. There's a very active prairie society in Texas. There's one in Louisiana. The one in Texas actually raised independent funding and are paying botanists to drive roads looking for them. They do aerial photography searches looking for the grass signature. But a lot of the credit, I think, would go to Charles Allen and Malcolm Vedrin, who were pioneers initially seeking out prairie remnants, and they showed me where a lot of them were when I first got started. Chris Reed with the Natural Heritage Program is a savant when it comes to botany. He's just an incredible field biologist, and he's actively, in all of his spare time, he said when he gets tired of looking at the computer screen, he pulls out aerial photography and looks for prairie.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of dedication, a lot of people out there working on it. And, you know, we hope it would be great if we can get a conservation easement on these big ranches. And, you know, there's interest. The Atwater prairie chicken, endangered species, is being captive bred, and there's interest in restoring enough prairie here to reintroduce it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even bringing bison back, I think, would be a fantastic thing for ecotourism, but for my children and grandchildren to be able to see the system that the Cajun prairies, and my grandfather was a Cajun prairie, you know, he had cattle and grew corn and, mm-hmm. and, you know, ate kush-kush. That's what the Cajun prairies mm-hmm. did. And my grandmother was a Bayou Cajun. So I'm very familiar with both cultures, but the prairie Cajuns, you know, the culture was very much in response to that habitat, and it was a brutal, hard place to live. But,
well, as you said, those plants are pretty competitive, trying to keep everyone else out.
That's right.
Well, for your practiced eye, and so I'm sure some people listening are thinking, well, I guess what I thought was prairie isn't really prairie. What does it look like just initially when you see something? How do you immediately know that it is prairie?
It takes practice. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw a prairie, someone gave me directions to it, and I walked across the prairie looking for it. And I got to the marsh, and I went, I must have missed it. And I turned around to walk back, and I saw a small orchid and bent down and looked at the orchid and said, well, it's not a plant I've seen before. And then I saw sabbatia, another a pink-flowered thing, and I started to realize that I didn't recognize the plants around me. Now, you know, at 60 mile an hour from a car window, we can spot it.
Mm-hmm.
When wildflowers in bloom, and a two-peak blooms, Blazing Star, which it gets 6 feet tall, and it's just magenta purple, beautiful thing. There are a bunch of indicator species. In fact, if you learn the indicator species, that would be a good way to hunt for prairie. There are particular species that if you don't see them south, if you see them south of I-10, it's clearly a prairie. They mm-hmm. don't occur in any other ecosystems.
Not north of
down
I-10.
Here. Well, north of I-10, there's longleaf pine. Prairie is not to get too technical, but is an ecotone between longleaf pine and marsh. It borrows species from both habitats. So if you were walking north on a prairie and you got to the piney woods and walked into the piney woods, you would see the same species underneath the pine trees. The soils on the prairie don't allow the pines to survive. And as you continue to you know, to walk further north, as the trees got denser, that vegetation would change. So it's a continuum. Mm-hmm. And on the south end of the continuum, there's wet prairie. And as you approach the marsh, you begin to see almost all wetland species, but it's still prairie. In fact, where they introduced the whooping cranes at White Lake, that ridge is wet prairie, and a good example, remnant of wet prairie. So switchgrass and eastern gamma grass was the dominant grass in the wet areas, and little blue stem, big blue stem Indian grass in the upper areas. So.
Well, you know, mentioning these names, I'm delighted with this lovely little brochure you gave me that is a compendium of these species, these flowers you're talking about. You published this a number of years ago, and it's called Paradise Lost, the Coastal Prairie of Louisiana and
Texas. It's on the Internet, by the way. You can find the brochure in PDF form on the Internet.
Okay, so it is not lost. You can find it online.
You can find it. Yes.
You are hoping soon, though, that it will be reprinted. It has already been printed
there's
once.
There's interest in doing that.
Okay, so we may all be able to actually
hold a
copy.
It's been printed twice, actually, but they're very popular. So.
Well, we'll look forward to it because it has the most beautiful photographs of the plants, the wildflowers, insects, and some of the animals. Let's talk about some of these. You talk about some of the indicator species that your eye immediately sees. But there are hundreds of flowers here that you have. And do they all bloom at once?
No. No, in fact, if you burn the prairie in the winter when the vegetation is brown and senesced and the north wind is blowing and the humidity is low, it burns right down to the ground. In February, things start to bloom. The first thing is a little low 3-inch tall yellow flowered thing called Eastern Star, and then there's Nothoscordum cropoison, and as the vegetation grows, different things bloom, and it builds to a crescendo in April and May when the false wild indigo that the Cajuns used to use to dye Easter eggs and a great diversity of things bloom in April and May. And then it goes through a slight dip, although there are always plants in bloom. There are always pollen and nectar available for the pollinators that live there. But there's another peak in August and September where the really tall flowering plants bloom. Blazing Star is by far the most dramatic. And in fact, there's a form of Blazing Star that's popular in the cut flower industry. We have about 7 species that grow all the way up to Canada. And so in the fall, it's really, really beautiful. And once you spend time in it, you begin the tall grasses bloom in the fall too, and they're really beautiful. It's a sort of an acquired taste, but once you spend time in it, you really fall in love with it. Indian grass in particular is just a really beautiful thing. Earth tones, you know, bronzes, blues, really, really nice.
Well, I can see why you called this Paradise Lost. I mean, just flipping through these pages would make anyone long to have more of this, more prairie where they could see these flowers. And some have actually gone extinct, haven't they?
Yeah.
Some flowers that you can no longer find. So this book, if anyone is interested in the species you're talking about, the flowers, the indicator plants, you can find Paradise Lost, the Coastal Prairie of Louisiana and Texas online right now. And hopefully soon there will be actual copies that you can have, again, created by my guest, botanist Larry Alain, who works with the National Wetlands Research Center. So you talk about the flowers that first pop up, you know, after a burn. Were those some of the things you did in your research? Did you actually go and burn prairie to see what would happen, to see the process of it coming back?
We did. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we looked at was what effect burning at different times of year had, because in the forest, you can look at tree rings and get some sense of when forested systems burn. But in the grassland, there's no record. And unfortunately, it's not well documented, you know, by the early settlers. So we don't know how frequently they burned or what time of year they burned. And they're, like everything in science, they're camps that are religiously believe their point of view. But the majority of the burns today are done in February and March because the vegetation is dead and the weather is right. Historically, we think probably a lot of the burns happened in the summer with lightning strike fires. So we did summer burns and winter burns and looked at how it affected the vegetation and primarily how it affected woody plants, because in the absence of fire, prairie turns into a forest. And, so it's not a climax community in that sense. And Chinese tallow is our public enemy number one on prairie. If you abandon a prairie strip, Chinese tallow germinates, or chicken trees, as we called them when I was young. And in 5 years, they suppress fuel and the fire won't go under them anymore. And so fire won't control them. So you have to be really aggressive with fire. But what's interesting is that all of these perennial plants are compressed at an amazing level that's not obvious at any given time. But there might be 30 species in a 1 foot by 1 foot area. And what grows in a given year has a lot to do with when it burned and the climate conditions. So you burn it in February, that year it might be predominantly grass. If you burn it in late March, it might be fall wildflowers. And all of the root systems are down there, but they don't express themselves until conditions are absolutely right. So you never see the same prairie twice. It's different every year, and rainfall affects it, and grazing affects it. And what's really amazing is that even in drought years, like 2011, when my bahia grass pasture at my farm turned brown, these prairie grasses continued to grow. They're adapted to it. So one of my interests is sustainable grazing and you know, raising livestock. You don't have to fertilize them. You don't have to water them or irrigate them. But you have to be an expert at grazing them. You can't just leave cows on them year-round like Bermuda grass or bahia grass. So it takes some expertise, but that is a branch of sustainable agriculture that is really, really growing right now, mm-hmm. using these native grasses. And wildflowers, too. We have a lot of legumes that bloom in the prairie, and they fix nitrogen in the soil. So because of their presence, you don't have to fertilize the plants. They take nitrogen out of the air and convert it into plant food. It's a remarkable system. It really is.
Well, and I love the way you talk about that root system and just waiting, biding its time and expressing itself under the right conditions. And I have an image of you having a very different sense of landscape than the rest of us, understanding all those root systems down there. And I think everyone listening can understand why you were given the 2014 Prairie Excellence Award this year. Again, my guest Larry Alla was just given this award by the Coastal Prairie Partnership in May for his work over the past couple decades in the prairies, the coastal prairies of Louisiana and Texas. He works with the National Wetlands Research Center and published just a gorgeous publication. It's called Paradise Lost, the Coastal Prairie of Louisiana and Texas. If you go online, you can find a PDF and see some of these plants that he's talking about and just learn more about what used to, cover our community, our land around here.
Right.
So if it is so difficult to restore prairie, how are you all doing that now? Again, you're not just going out and throwing some seed on the ground. How do you go about restoring a prairie area?
What we try and do is work with the way that ecological systems work. When you plow ground, the ground begins to recover. You get weedy species in the beginning and eventually more conservative species that are longer lived, and they prepare the ground for the plants that follow. And the system evolves over time. It's called succession. So we try and work with succession. So if it's a plowed rice field or a beat up, what we call an old agricultural field, we'll plow the soil and prepare a good seed bed and start with seeds. And the problem is that there's so little left that the seed is very expensive and very labor intensive to collect. So generally restorations are restricted to small areas. which is why we started the Louisiana Native Plant Initiative, to try and grow seed. So we plant the seeds and we roll it. And the first year, you despair because it's all weeds. It takes a strong constitution and a real belief that it's going to work. By the end of the second year, you begin to see a few prairie things here and there. By the third year, it starts to turn into prairie. So what happens is these long-lived perennial species begin, they make a couple of little leaves and they begin to grow an extensive root system. The weedy species is like the grasshopper in the ant parable. They grow very quickly with shallow roots and they make a lot of above ground growth and then they die and then their seeds germinate again. By the third year, the perennials own the soil and the weedy species germinate, but they can't compete, so they get displaced. Fire speeds up that process, so we try and burn the prairies. Things that are very rare sometimes we grow in greenhouses and transplant into the site. Some of the best restorations have been rescues where we dig up sod on prairie remnants that are destined to be covered by a parking lot or a highway improvement project. And when you transplant prairie, it does much better than when you grow it from seed. Unfortunately, that's not a sustainable way to do it. And I suspect the reason it does better is because you're moving a clump of soil, and the soil biota, it's like the far side of the moon. We know very little about what goes on in the soil. It's a real growth area in research right now. But the soil biota have fungi and bacteria and invertebrates that have formed partnerships with these plants and give the plants competitive edge. And they allow the plants to get moisture below the clay hard pan where other plants can't. There are just an untold number of adaptations. So when you transplant sod, you move that soil biota. And those restorations, like the one in Eunice, is a remarkable example of prairie restoration. But even if you can create a grassland that's, you know, doesn't necessarily have to have 200 species of prairie plants, but if you have 10 or 12 or 20, it's still useful to grassland birds, which are the most rapidly declining group of birds in North America, like the meadowlark, which when I was a kid we used to see on every third fence post. The Henslow sparrow, LeConte sparrow, birds like that, and the northern bobwhite quail, which even if you're not a flower lover, if you're a hunter, quail populations have been really, really diving over the last few decades, and prairie was their natural habitat. In fact, we're doing a butterfly survey at one of the restorations at Lacassine. I went there this morning and I saw a covey of bobwhite quail. I haven't seen a covey in the wild since I was in high school. So
all this work on the coastal prairies is perhaps helping bring that balance back.
I hope so.
If anyone would like more information about what you're talking about, Larry, and we'd love to have you come back to talk about some of these areas that perhaps people can visit and just more about it, because it's certainly a part of our heritage and you're talking about beautiful things that we would all like to experience. Is there, in addition to downloading the brochure, is there a site perhaps that you all are working on that can give more people more information?
There are several sites. We call it coastal prairie is what scientists call it, and in general we call it coastal prairie. In Louisiana it's called Cajun prairie. But if you Google either of those terms, you'll get several hits. The Coastal Prairie Partnership's got a really, really nice website with a lot of imagery and graphics and videos and information. The Louisiana Cajun Prairie Society has a nice website that has a calendar of events that you can attend if you want to learn more about it. So there are a lot of resources on internet.
And in addition, Larry's publication is Paradise Lost, The Coastal Prairie of Louisiana and Texas, available online as well. Larry, thank you so much for coming by to tell us more about the Coastal Prairie, and congratulations on your 2014 Prairie Excellence Award, which I think everyone listening can tell you well deserved. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.